Well, here we are, class one in globalization since 1492. I'm Anthony Hall. I'm the instructor of this course, and I'm also the founding coordinator of Globalization Studies. It's an initiative of the university started in 2003. And the idea emerged, since we're talking about globalization, why not use the new technology, which is a primary medium of globalization, the internet, and use the interactive capacity of the internet, the communicative capacity of the internet, the interactive capacity, you can talk back and forth, television that talks back. Why not use that to conduct a discussion around the world on globalization? And we soon discovered that all we had to do was make a few connections and could stream it to the world. That is quite a powerful concept, that using the interactive capacity and streaming it out so it's available, like anything on the internet, everywhere in the world. There's never been a communicative tool like this in the history of humankind. And I, for one, started to think about the whole subject in a different way, or in a perhaps a deeper or more nuanced way, as I began to think of the spaces that we create, that in a sense, we're here in this particular place in Lethbridge, Alberta, but once we turn on the switch, we're also present anywhere in the world. The directors on the master control in the panel there, in a sense, this is like Christopher Columbus out navigating the planet. So there is something about doing it this way that engages us or takes us into a conceptual place that is a conceptual place unlike any other generation, any other people in the history of humankind up until now have dealt with. And it really is just mind-boggling as we discover that virtually every kind of information can be rendered into this bits and bytes. It can be digitalized. And I recall very well, if we go to the document camera, so I will ask a switch to take place to the document camera. I used to attend seminars when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto with Marshall McLuhan. Here's Marshall McLuhan as he was, as I recall him. He invited Pierre Trudeau to the class one night. I wasn't at that class. But Marshall McLuhan was a huge figure. He was a guru of the media. He philosophized about print media, radio, television. He was much in demand to speak to corporations about the new media. And he coined phrases like the global village. The medium is the message. Phrases that had a lot of currency at the time. I think you probably heard the word global village. When I think back to how he talked, it was almost as if personal computers and the whole internet system was already there. He would talk about a white light as sort of pure information, and then there's no limit to the extent to which you can put information in that white light. And of course, we saw it in a period of history where you put celluloid in front of white light and you can make photographs, and then you can make the photographs move by running them by quickly by the white light. But it turns out now with switching, just on, off, on, off, on, off, you can turn that light into every kind of imaginable message and digitalize information here. But I'd like to start a little. I'd like to start with some issues of substance, and I'm going to. We can go to the document camera, I'm going to. And I kind of use the document camera like a blackboard. I'm going to call tonight's talk walls and bridges, convergences and networks. So I'm going to talk, of course, about walls and bridges. I suppose the internet is a kind of bridge. Convergences, things coming together, converging, and of course networks, a hugely important concept, say with in terms of the internet. So let's look at the Lethbridge Herald, October 1st, 2005. And here is a promotion to go hiking on the Great Wall. And the Great Wall of China is, of course, one of the famous walls of the earth. A wall. What was this wall about? It was to keep out the barbarians, the savages, and to protect Chinese civilization. And of course, the a wall was started over 2,000 years ago, but much of it was built during the Ming Dynasty, 1368 to 1644. And the Great Wall of China is certainly one of the most photographed places on Earth. It can be seen from outer space. And of course, walls, I think, are a good way to introduce globalization, insofar as globalization often is associated with the removal of walls and the ability of peoples to transcend prior barriers. So where the oceans of the world had separated humanity, after 1492 especially, the oceans of the world become a medium of interactivity whereby human beings start to mix and mingle in ways that they hadn't before. So the concept of walls and the concept of building walls to keep out certain influences that you deem to be, that a given society deems to be alien influences, barbarian influences or savage influences, this raises the concept that once you remove that wall, then you, of course, you create the context where the opposite can take place. People can intermix and mingle. So perhaps if we go back to the document camera, I don't know if you recognize that fellow. That's me last Christmas at the Great Wall. And there was of course, it's a tourist place, and it was many, many tourists. It was winter, so there wasn't the huge influx of tourists. But it was interesting, most of the tourists were from different parts of Asia, different parts of China or Malaysia or Indonesia or India, and they were tourists coming to see the Great Wall. And of course, tourism and easy travel is part of the phenomena that is bringing about globalization in a way, at a speed, at a rate, at an intensity that we haven't seen in human history previously. So, the wall, and here we go. So there's the Great Wall of China. The Berlin Wall was an extremely important symbol of the Cold War. And of course, the Cold War, after World War II, there was a period where it seemed that humanity was faced with a basic choice between two powerful systems. Communism, if we go back to the docu-camera, communism and capitalism. Now, was communism looked at as a kind of barbarism or as a kind of savagery on the other side of the wall? You know, once you put a wall in place, the wall automatically symbolizes a kind of dichotomy. And I think as I grew up, and this wall was sort of there, was, you know, as a child you don't have a full understanding, but you can certainly have the sense that you were encouraged to think, well, you're on the side of the wall where the people in West Berlin live. You're on the side of the wall associated with the United States, associated with capitalism. And then there's a far side of the wall, the other side of the wall. And that's the very concept of the wall encourages you to think, well, that's the other people. That's some kind of alien regime, some hostile regime. The communist regime. So as we'll see, there was many constituencies in the world who really objected to the idea that, hey, humanity is more complex. There isn't just two options. There's any number of options. The people who lived in colonies that had been created by European powers, European empires, the people who lived in colonies were just coming out of that condition where European powers made many of the decisions for them. But they said, you know, don't force us to choose between socialism and capitalism, between a network focused on the Soviet Union and a network of power focused on the United States. We're ancient peoples. We have our own ways of life. And those peoples met at Bandung in 1955, Bandung is in Indonesia. They met under the auspices of a leader in Indonesia who had taken over from the Dutch imperialists for an independent Indonesia, Sukarno. But it turns out that Sukarno was seen to be this idea that you're not with the capitalists or you're not with the United States. Eventually, Sukarno was removed and Suharto, a general, was put in his place in a U.S.-British-backed coup. And then a million people were murdered, a million people around the PK, the Communist Party of Indonesia. Sukarno wasn't a communist himself, but he supported the concept that the communists were a legitimate part of the overall political mix of Indonesia. So the response in this way was sort of, you've got to choose. You can't be neutral. You've got to choose one side or the other. So when George W. Bush, early on in what they're now calling the War on Terror, said, well, either you are with us, and if you're not with us, you're with the terrorists. To me, this was a very familiar theme, going back to the Cold War, saying that we're not going to accept a kind of neutral zone. You pretty well have to choose, and if you don't choose our side, we assume you're on the other side. So I'm talking about walls here. Now let's pull back the focus here and see that this wall is in Palestine, Israel, or Israel-Palestine. So there are two peoples who see themselves as the legitimate inhabitants of the same territory. Some call themselves Palestinians, some call themselves Israelis. And of course, the tension over who is going to control that land and how that land might be separated or how that land might be shared or not shared or fought over, that is one of the very tense spots on the planet right now. So here is some Palestinian kids playing. Let's go to the picture A9. So here is a picture of this new wall. And you can see that here is West Jerusalem, goes around here. And so here is one side of the wall. And then the other side of the wall is a Jewish settlement in the West Bank. And those settlements are highly controversial. So this wall, this new wall, what should we call this wall? Is it a fence? Is it a security barrier? I'd say that this is the wall of the war on terror. And the war on terror raises all kinds of questions. Who defines what terror is? We live in what's called Western civilization. We come from all over the planet. How did Western civilization come to be? There was a civil war in England in the 1640s. Cromwell was one of the revolutionaries. Eventually, the English king had his head cut off. Eventually, Parliament was restored, but the monarchy was taken down a few notches, so Parliament acquired some kind of supremacy. How did that happen? It didn't happen in a negotiating chamber. It happened with blood and guts and violence. There was an event in British North America known as the American Revolution. What is the American Revolution? The American Revolution began as a civil war where those who wanted to secede, to separate from the British Empire, took up arms and violently oppose the regime of the imperial government of King George III. And isn't it ironic, or doesn't it bear some kind of discussion, or isn't it paradoxical that the government leading the war on terror has as its own origins, an act whereby certain Anglo-Americans chose to take up arms, accept the generalship of a former British general, George Washington, and revolt against the duly constituted authority. This was shortly followed in France by another revolution where the people charged the Bastille and declared liberté, égalité, fraternité. And the French Revolution in 1789 is an act of violence directed at removing what is seen as a corrupt, overripe civilization and replacing it with a new regime, a less corrupt regime, a democratic regime. But of course, as oftentimes happens, when the new regime takes power, then it turns out that there's plenty of agreement what you're against. You're against the dictatorship or the tyranny of a monarch that holds all the power. You're against so much power being put in the church. You're against aristocrats owning all the land. But then when you have to create a government, you turn against each other. So the French Revolution is very much associated with the guillotine. And so one faction started simply assassinating the other factions, and out of this emerged a new a strong man, a general, Napoleon, and he kind of justified his assumption of power as a defense of the ideals of the French Revolution, but then he sought to export the French Revolution through building up military, through violence, and eventually overextended himself into Russia, the huge Russian territory combined with the Russian winter did him in like it would do in a similar visionary or tyrant Adolf Hitler in the Second World War. Certainly the Russian Revolution is a very important part of our history. And here is a critique of the system of ownership and private property and apportionment of wealth. Karl Marx looks at the system of production, looks at the Industrial Revolution, theorizes that there is a capitalist class who is exploiting the working class by essentially theft of their surplus labor. And this becomes the justification for the Bolsheviks, for Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. The Russian Revolution is an important part of world history, Western civilization's history. There's a Mao Zedong absorbs, yes, he's going to westernize to some extent. He's going to make some compromises with the West. The wall eventually is permeated. It's interesting, this concept in China. China is the most ancient civilization, consistent civilization on Earth. It's a very big and elaborate and complex civilization, and it's so self-sufficient unto itself that it really didn't feel it needed to absorb from the outside. Certainly Europeans wanted the wonderful products, the beautiful things from China. They wanted that civilization's creative ideas, and they took gunpowder and paper and printing. Marco Polo writes about the Silk Road, and there is this overland route. But the Europeans can't really get into China. How do the Europeans eventually breach the wall or the construction, the psychological construction of the wall? They advance and promote drug addiction. The Opium War, 1840 to 1842, you actually have a Chinese government intent on regulating the drug trade, banning and prohibiting the drug trade. British Navy counter that. And so the sale of opium from India by the East India Company in China becomes crucial to the economics of the British Empire. It's interesting when you think of empire building, global trade networks, how much of the early kickstarting of these imperial systems have to do with the trade in addictive substances. And simply think of, you know, where did Virginia, how did Virginia, where George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, how did Virginia get into the world economy? Through tobacco. Tobacco is addictive. Tobacco is taken from the Indians. Tobacco seems to be all through North and Central and South America. It seems to be a ubiquitous aspect of life in the Western Hemisphere. And everywhere you see it associated with ceremonies, with religious rituals, with, you know, reflection and meetings. And, you know, there's many, many accounts of treaty ceremonies where it will begin with, you know, smoking the peace pipe. Doing certain rituals with the pipe. You know, I've heard comments about reflecting on the gift of Indians to the Europeans was tobacco, was abused. The gift to Indians from Europeans was whiskey, it was alcohol, was abused. It's you know, there's a powerful sensibility to that. So alcohol is important in the globalization of trade. What is rum made out of? Molasses, sugar cane. Sugar is can be seen as a kind of drug. Sugar can be seen as a kind of addictive substance. Sugar is closely connected to the slave trade, the rise of the transatlantic slave trade. So opium, tobacco, alcohol, coffee, tea, sugar. It's interesting to contemplate how this global trade gets going. So this transcending of barriers through global trade is a topic, but these walls that keep coming up. You know, here we were in a period where the Berlin Wall came down, and this was seen as a moment of triumph for the United States of America. It was seen as a moment of triumph for capitalism. And I'm quite sure that the seizing upon the word globalization is closely associated with the reality that once the Soviet Union was removed as an obstacle, and what a shock that was, you know, to be told all your life there is this evil empire that is so menacing and so threatening that you have to take part in devoting a huge part of your economy, of your creative processes, to building up your defenses, your nuclear preparedness, your psychological warfare, your covert operations to protect yourself from this evil empire, the Soviet Union, and one day it suddenly just implodes. It's not there anymore. And it caused you to wonder, was it really as menacing and threatening as it was made out to us?